from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Marisa Lagos in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a coalition of doctors, scientists, and health experts is calling for tougher regulation of chemicals found in common household items, just weeks after Congress finally passed a long-debated update to federal law. We'll talk to health researchers about why they issued the call to action and how you can keep your family safe. Next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome back to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos, and today for Michael Krasny. A coalition of doctors, scientists, medical associations, and other health advocates is calling for tougher regulation of chemicals found in household products. This hour, we're talking to members of that coalition about why tougher rules are necessary and how to keep your family safe now. Joining me are Sonia Lunder, senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group, which is a nonprofit that conducts public health research and issues consumer guides on products. Sonia is joining us from Colorado. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We also have Irva Hertz-Picotto, chief of environmental and occupational health at UC Davis's Public Health Sciences Department. Her research focuses on understanding the causes of autism and other developmental disorders. She founded and co-directed the group calling for action on these chemicals, and she's joining us from Davis. Good morning, Irva.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And finally, Asa Bradman is here. He's the Associate Director of UC Berkeley's Center for Environmental Research and Children's Health. He focuses on pregnant women and children's exposure to environmental toxins and also signed on to the call for action known as Project Tender. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Irva, I'd like to start with you. You founded and led this Project Tender, which is short for Targeting Environmental Neurodevelopmental Risks. Tell me a little bit about this paper, who signed on, and what all these scientists and doctors are saying here.
Thank you. Yes. So Project Tender really is a result of the scientific evidence and studies such as ones that Asa Bradman has been involved in, our group, groups all over the country, finding more and more evidence that the chemical environment that we all live in, including air, water, food, household products, is actually linked to deficits in child neurodevelopment, and that includes cognitive impairments, in other words, lower scores on IQ tests, attention deficit disorders, and hyperactivity, as well as autism spectrum disorder. And that link is something that we need to look at as a wake-up call. And in about a year and a half ago, I got together with a woman from the Learning Disabilities Association, and we started talking about here's all this science and what's actually happening with that science. How is that being translated into policies or legislation or actual changes in exposures? And, she asked me, so that question, how is it happening? And I could not come up with very many examples, and the examples were really fairly old ones, such as, taking lead out of gasoline in the 1970s and around 2000, restricting use of certain pesticides for household products, but allowing them still in agriculture and other uses. So we decided it was time to get a group together, and we decided it should not be a huge group. We just wanted to get representation from scientists, researchers, along with the health providers, health professionals, physicians and nurses, and also link up with some of the environmental and child advocacy organizations and see if we could come to some kind of agreement. And that's where we began working on the consensus statement. So that's what was published Friday in the Environmental Health Perspective.
And just, Yeah, and just to make sure our listeners understand, because I know there's a lot of debate, obviously, over, you know, what causation versus correlation. And what you guys are saying is that there's clearly other factors that lead to some of these disabilities and deficits, but that these sort of toxins and chemicals are part of that list. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. We don't say this is all of it. And I think it really is important for listeners to understand that most health conditions, and that's not just these kinds of developmental ones, but, you know, blood pressure, you know, diabetes, they all have multiple causes. And that really means that we have to always think broadly and think about nutrition and think about physical activity. But the chemical environment is one component of that. And it's certainly one that we can be acting on and changing.
That's great. I want to move on to Sonia Lender for a second. We're going to delve in a little deeper into what kind of chemicals and products we're talking about. But Sonia, your group does a ton of research and advocacy around identifying unsafe products and educating consumers and lobbying for stronger regulations. And I know that you call this coalition unprecedented. And so I wanted you to kind of put in context for us, why is this such a big deal to you?
Well, I'm a trained scientist, and I know that it is common for scientists to look at uncertainty and to say we need to take another look, or we don't know conclusively enough to take action. You know, give me a couple more years. And so when I see scientists and mentors of mine in my training saying, no, this is enough, we can take action, we need to do more, this really gets my attention. And to see scientists teaming up with physicians who are often also very cautious about drawing that link between cause and effect, as you mentioned, really saying, here are six types of chemicals. We know that exposure is widespread throughout the American population, and we see that we're not doing enough to study those effects. We're not getting bad chemicals off the market, and we're not fully protecting kids. That really is a call to action and one that we definitely support.
Great. Well, I know we're going to get to the sort of regulatory structure in a bit, but Asa Bradman, you do a lot of work around monitoring pregnant women and kids. And I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of sense of the real world impacts of these chemicals and why are children so vulnerable? Why is this the population we're talking about here?
Well, just to provide a little context, I personally got involved in the tender statement partly because of my experience as a parent. And anecdotally, I'm amazed at the number of children among my peer group who have developmental challenges around ADHD, autism. When I talk to teachers in my children's school, they talk about problems with kids that seems to have changed over the last 10, 20, 30 years. And that really kind of drew me to this statement. I got interested in issues around children's environmental health really because a growing understanding that children are more vulnerable to toxic substances. And there's kind of three components to that. Especially young children actually have higher exposures per unit of body weight than adults. They eat, drink, and breathe more than we do. So if there's a contaminant in that environment, they get more into their bodies. They also have a lot of behaviors like hand-to-mouth behavior, spending time on the floor, getting into stuff. And then if there's any contaminants in house dust or on surfaces, again, it gets into their body either through ingestion or absorption through the skin. They also, in many cases, are unable to metabolize toxic chemicals and get them out of their body. We've been looking at that with pesticides, but there's other examples. And finally, children's systems are changing and developing rapidly. And so an insult to those processes can kind of knock things out of whack. When I try to explain this, I usually talk about neural architecture. And if we can imagine the Leaning Tower of Pisa, it's standing, it kind of works, but it's not quite right. Well, for a child whose neurological system is developing, that architecture can get disrupted by a neurotoxin like lead, and that may have long-term impacts in terms of their ability to learn and you know, function in the world. And I think those are important pieces that have driven many of us to become concerned about the results that we're finding in our research.
That's a Asa Bradman. He is co-founder of the Center for Environmental Research and Children's Health at UC Berkeley. And Asa, can you just follow up too? I mean, I know you've looked specifically at pesticides in pregnant women in the Central Valley. Is that right? I mean, are there specific take pesticides? Is there something you can draw a pretty clear line to when we talk about these developmental issues, a type of developmental problem?
Well, we've been looking at a number of different exposures in a population in the Salinas Valley. A lot of our work is focused on pesticides and organophosphate pesticides. We've also worked on flame retardants and other potential toxicants. In our work with pesticides, we've actually found fairly consistent associations, particularly with prenatal exposure and poor developmental outcomes in the children. And you're right in your earlier statement about these studies show associations, not causation. And that's one of the challenges in this kind of research. You know, we can't go into a population and intentionally expose one group and not another and do an experiment like we might do with a pharmaceutical. However, when we look at studies like ours, we look for consistency in results over time, which we're finding at different age points. We also look at other studies. For example, in New York City, there's been work with many of the same pesticides that were used indoors, especially prior to about 10 years ago. So these have raised concerns. There's also been trends, though, for example, with OP pesticides uses declining. And there are alternatives being developed, but then we have to think carefully about what kinds of alternatives are being developed, and I think support policies that encourage the adoption of, you know, less toxic approaches, in this case for pest control, but also in other arenas of commerce and consumer products.
Yeah, and Irva Hertz-Picotto, I'd like to talk to you about that because I know that, you know, some of these things, insecticides, pesticides, lead, mercury, we've known about for years. But a lot of the things you guys are focusing on also exist in consumer product, household products. Tell me a little bit about that. What kind of products are we talking about? And what are the dangerous chemicals that you guys are identifying here?
Yes. Well, first, I just want to say my name is Irva Hertz-Picotto.
Picotto, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. So we, in our consensus statement, we have focused on a small set, and I will preface everything I say about those chemicals with the larger context here is that there are actually tens of thousands of chemicals out in commerce, most of which have not been tested because they were grandfathered in when much of the legislation that we have was passed. In other words, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. Grandfathered in kind of existing chemicals. And then now we introduce new chemicals, and we require some kinds of testing. Usually for most of the testing is focused on acute effects, effects that are seen rapidly after an exposure occurs. And so that could be liver toxicity, or it could be, you know, kidney failure. And even the prenatal exposures that we look at, we tend to focus, the testing that's done tends to focus on these kind of gross malformations like, you know, skeletal problems. The effects of the chemicals that we're talking about are subtle. They are what we think of as a long-term, sometimes delayed effect. In other words, the exposure can happen during the prenatal period. The placenta is not a barrier. It actually facilitates the delivery of many of these compounds. And that leads to then these early exposures, which sometimes don't manifest right away. And some of them, it may take a few years to start seeing some of these neurodevelopmental types of effects take place. So the chemicals that we are focusing on are just a small group. We wanted to focus attention on some prime examples. And those are examples of, each of them is a little bit different. The lead, of course, we had for, you know, around, and we've known about its toxicity to children for well over 100 years, close to 150 years, actually. We are also, but we're going beyond lead. Many people, of course, are aware of lead, Flint,
right?
It's really drawn attention.
Can you talk a little bit about the endocrine disrupting chemicals? Because I think those are ones that are newer in the public's knowledge.
Yes. So one of them is the flame retardants, these polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs. Those are compounds that are persistent. They last a long time, both in the environment and in the body. They affect thyroid hormones. They affect some of the other endocrine systems, and that's why we call them endocrine disruptors. So both thyroid hormones and the sex hormones of testosterone and estrogen are really critical in early brain development. And not having enough or having them not enough at the right time in development can actually cause the brain to go awry. So we used to think of you know, neurodevelopment as only being a question of these direct neurotoxins. But it turns out that there are maybe multiple pathways to interfere with that developing brain, and the endocrine system is one. There are possibly immune functions, and much of our work on autism, we've seen that there are there is a dysregulation of immune function, and that immune cells are really, really important to the brain as well.
Yeah.
They're active in the brain, protecting the brain. So polybrominated dichonyl ethers, they are found in a variety of products. Even though we have now virtually banned them, they are going to be around for a long time. So they are in foam mattresses, they are in cushions, they are in textiles, they are in carpet backing. They were also used in the plastic casings of electronics, fax machines, things like that. They're really very pervasive, and they can be measured now in in virtually everyone in the U.S. The levels are higher in the U.S. than they are in Europe, which actually banned them sooner, and they are higher in California than in other parts of the country because California's laws there was a very strong lobby here in California that was trying to raise the standards for how much flame retardant you needed in order to prevent an item from catching, bursting into flame.
Great, thank you, Irva. I'm going to invite our listeners to join the discussion. I'm sure they have a lot of questions for our panel. If you have questions or want to add a comment, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Sonia Lunder, I wanted to talk to you because another area that this report highlights is phthalates in consumer products. And I know that's an issue that EWG has been sort of trying to inform consumers on for a long time with your guides to sunscreen and other products. Can you just tell me a little bit about what we're talking about here and where you find them? What's the issue?
Yeah, phthalates are a group of chemicals that are used to soften PVC plastic. And so we find them in vinyl products, vinyl shower curtains. They used to be in vinyl toys, like inflatable beach toys. We find them in food packaging and also in tubing and different things that are used in the production of food. So they end up being contaminants in the food supply as well. We're very concerned because they're highly toxic to the male reproductive system by altering male sex hormones. And we see that we actually find or observe effects in epidemiological studies with baby boys' reproductive development being associated with the amount of phthalates in a mom's body during pregnancy. But we're also seeing signs that they affect brain development as well.
I was just going to say that I just see a lot of products these days advertising that they are phthalate-free. So from a consumer perspective, I mean, is that something that you would suggest people are looking for on the labels? Or are labels even a good way to decide these things?
Well, labels are definitely an important consumer tool, especially when there's so little action on the part of the federal government to restrict harmful chemicals. One place that phthalates are also found is in body care products that have the term fragrance on the label. And fragrance is a catch-all term that represents a lot of different chemicals that provide smell, but phthalates were historically used to make fragrances stick longer on your skin and last longer on your body. So phthalate-free on a cosmetic product would be a helpful sign to distinguish a better product. But also we have to think about the substitutes that we use. And I found that when some phthalates were banned in children's toys, that the industry proposed related chemicals in the phthalate family to replace them. So we're concerned about the fact that sometimes substitutes to toxic chemicals are rushed to market without being well studied, or we don't take into account the fact that they may have a very similar effect on the human body.
All right. Well, we're going to continue that, but we have a question. Joan in San Jose has a question, I think, for Asa.
Yes, and with in an area where there's a lot of agricultural production and wind and blowing pesticides, we don't know what they are, but coming off of fields or other toxins, is there any inexpensive place we can take a sample of air, and how would you collect a sample of air to see what's in it, considering there's tens of thousands of potential toxins? And as a private citizen, not as a, you know, pass the legislature, pass government laws, just see what's privately affecting you as a private citizen and your family.
Thank you, Joan. That's a great question.
Unfortunately, I can't answer that question easily. Collecting air samples is very challenging, and there are few laboratories that will, analyze just one sample for anything close to a reasonable price. There have been some community-based studies conducted by some advocacy groups like Pesticide Action Network, where they have used kind of a simple bucket sampler, essentially collecting an air sample in a plastic bucket or other ways of doing that. I'd have to go back and look at their methods. And then they were able to work with a laboratory. Typically, though, laboratory analyses are very expensive, and they're not easy. There are some, I know a group at Davis and others that are trying to develop simpler methods, but often those are chemical specific. So there's a lot of challenges there. It's easier to test for things like lead. There's contract laboratories that do these things on a routine basis, but pesticides and other organic chemicals are hard to assess on an individual basis. If anyone else out there has more information, though, I'd love to hear about that.
Great.
Yeah, I could just add that what Asa said is absolutely true. There aren't really places to go now, but there is a lot of work going on in terms of research to develop little ways to use sensors that can be worn on the body, and ultimately, as the technology gets better, we will be able to measure lots of chemicals with a little wristwatch. There's one, there's a little bracelet that's been being developed by one group I know on the East Coast. Here at Davis, there are people working on a little sensor that can be used for measuring chemicals and actually helping people with asthma.
That was Irva Hurt-Pichotto. Thank you so much. We're going to continue our conversation about toxic chemicals and their health impacts and how you can protect your family after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion or have questions about products your family uses, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Marisa Lagos, and today for Michael Krasny, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Marisa Lagos, and today for Michael Krasny. We're discussing how chemicals used in common household products and furniture could be impacting your child's development, and why a coalition of doctors and scientists is calling for stricter regulation of these chemicals. Joining us are Sonia Lunder, who conducts research on toxic chemicals at the nonprofit Environmental Working Group, UC Davis's Irva Hurst-Pichotto, who research focuses on environmental toxins, including their links to autism, and Asa Bradman, a UC Berkeley epidemiologist who studies the impact of pollutants on pregnant women and children. And now we're joined by Alex Guillen. He's a Politico energy reporter who's joining us from D.C., where there was recently some action on this issue of regulating chemicals. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for being with us. I was hoping you could just give us a little bit of information about this update to the Toxic Substance Control Act. It was a long time in coming and a rare bipartisan bill. What's this legislation doing, and what does it really mean for chemical regulation?
Yeah, this is something you don't see too often in Washington, particularly when it comes to environmental laws in the past few years. This update, what it does is it looks at the law known as TSCA, like you said. What happened was that law was passed in 1976, but over the past 40 years, it proved to be very difficult to implement and kind of toothless when it came down to it. EPA ended up only really restricting five substances over that time. And stuff like trying to get asbestos outright banned failed in court. So there was a lot of movement toward making changes and updates to that program. On the one side, very important to this effort was interest in the industry in making these changes, because it was facing an increasing patchwork of regulations from the states. States like California and New York were starting to implement very aggressive programs. Other states were not. But when you're a manufacturer selling a product nationwide, you end up having to meet the strictest standard. So there was interest from environmentalists in boosting this, in the industry in changing it, and Democrats and Republicans were able to come together and make some pretty key changes to the program.
But not everybody's happy with this, obviously. And I think this is something that California Senator Barbara Boxer worked long and hard on. I mean, what did you hear from folks who wanted even stronger regulations about this compromise?
Yeah, this is one of those things that in true Washington fashion is a compromise where you might say nobody is happy. That's not entirely true, of course. A lot of people are happy with how this came out, despite certainly calls from many for stricter laws and regulations here. One thing Senator Boxer had a problem with for a lot of the negotiations over this bill was state preemption, which is when state efforts, like what California has done for a long time, take a back seat to federal efforts. She eventually came on board to the program after some key changes were made, one of them being that states can take action on chemicals if the federal EPA has not. Mm-hmm. So it gives states a little more flexibility while still giving the industry the sort of nationwide regulation they were actually looking for.
And are you hearing anything sort of beyond this in Washington? This seems like, like we said, there's a sort of decades in the making, and we may not see any revisiting of this for a while.
Absolutely. And to be honest, implementation of this, the reform law, is going to take many years in and of itself. Not to mention, of course, it puts in place the framework to look at chemicals that are already in the marketplace and, of course, the many new chemicals that will come onto the marketplace as well. So there could certainly, we'll find out what works really well and what doesn't under this new law. But that's something that will take years, maybe even decades.
Great. Well, thanks so much. That's Alex Guillen. He's the Politico's energy reporter in Washington, D.C. We really appreciate your time, Alex.
Thank you.
So I want to turn to some of our listener comments and calls. I'm going to read a couple comments first. Ben writes, I've read about plastics leaching into our foods and that almost all humans have unhealthy levels of PCBs in their bodies. I was wondering what actions we can take to mitigate this effect. For instance, should I stop microwaving anything in plastic containers? Are there more precautions we should take? Jesse writes, I've recently been seeing commercials from law firms claiming that Johnson's baby powder has been linked to ovarian cancer. Can anyone speak the truth to this? Does anybody want to take either of those specifically? Asa, can you talk about the plastic issue?
I can talk about the plastics. I mean, that is a big issue right now. Historically, it's been focused on the use of bisphenol A and BPA, which has been used in hard plastics and is a known endocrine disruptor. It's been controversial in some settings in terms of regulation, but it clearly leaches into plastics. And this, I think, is a really good example. Because to replace it, there's been a number of related compounds that have used in new plastic materials that are BPA-free, but may also, in fact, leach into things like water or baby milk or things like that, and may actually cause some of the same issues we're concerned about. So I think this gets to the whole general issue of this term regrettable substitutes and the need to really vet materials when we use them, and also make sure that when we choose substitutes that they're safe. And I think in some ways there are short-term things that we can do. I think using glass is actually a good alternative to many plastics. You should never microwave plastics in never any kind of plastic, just flat out.
Just don't do it.
yeah. But you know, some of these changes are going to be generational. You know, UC Berkeley has a green chemistry program. There are a lot of research going on in the private sector and chemical companies to try to identify materials that are safer. In the European Union, in their REACH program, which is a new chemicals policy program, there's an emphasis on understanding safety before we use materials. I think it's important not to demonize the private sector, but engage that whole universe of players here and stakeholders to kind of move towards a better approach.
Thanks. That is Asa Bradman. And we should mention that we did contact industry. We called the American Chemistry Council, the industry trade group for chemical companies, as well as Chemtura, one of the leading flame retardant manufacturers. They both declined to participate, but the Chemistry Council did send us a blog post in which they talked about Project Tender, which we've been discussing, saying the group kind of has tunnel vision and that they are solely focused on safety, not ensuring that products work as intended. I'm going to let that stand for now. We can get back to it, but I have Ashley here from San Francisco with a question for our panel.
Hi, yes. My question is, as a consumer, I'd just like to know what in each of the opinions of the panel members, what are the top three things I can do to limit the effects of chemicals on my health?
Thanks, Ashley. Sonia Lender, do you want to take that first?
Wow, that's a tricky one, and I know that people have a limited capacity to make lots of changes in their life. It's really hard to start with three, but I would start with eating organic food and buying organic food when possible, because in addition to ensuring that food is grown without synthetic pesticides, there are also restrictions on dyes and preservatives and other ingredients in packaged food, and also then you wouldn't be getting any food with genetically modified ingredients. So that's a nice catch-all when it comes to food, especially when you're pregnant or feeding a kid. And EWG has a shopper's guide to pesticides and produce that highlights the conventionally grown fruits and vegetables with the most and least pesticide residues on them. I think one thing people don't know is that most conventional produce has some pesticide residues on it when you buy it, even after you wash it and are preparing to eat it. Another thing is to that's really actionable and easy is to use EWG's Healthy Living app, which has barcode scanning and gives you information about the ingredients in food and also in body care products from our Skin Deep database. And you can get lots of good actionable information about products with ingredients that might be concerning, both for endocrine disruption or other effects they may have, and find healthier or safer products with our app. And number three, just in terms of a very actionable thing, I actually encourage people to use a HEPA vacuum. And when they're cleaning their house, if you have little kids who are playing on the floor, putting their hands in their mouth, we want to have a good way of cleaning your house that actually gets dust and contaminants out. If you have lead in your paint or fire retardants in your furniture, which you're likely to have in the U.S. right now, this is one way to ensure that when you're cleaning, you're not just taking contaminants and dust and suspending them into the air, but you're actually using a high-efficiency vacuum filter to trap them and get them out of your environment.
Great. Thanks, Sonia Lender. She's an EWG researcher. I wanted to go back to our question from the listener about Johnson's baby powder. Does anybody want to tackle that? I know that Johnson's & Johnson's did pledge to remove some of these chemicals in coming years. I don't know if there's a direct link to ovarian cancer. Sonia Lender or Irva Hirsch-Picciotto?
This is Sonia. I would say that we recommend people avoid using powders, both on their babies or on their own skin, powder makeup on your face, mostly because of inhalation concerns. Talc is one ingredient to avoid, and you can use our Skin Deep database to identify products with talc. But in any case, you know, you inhale some of those particles. You're not supposed to use baby powders actually on babies. And there are, you know, lotions or other ways of treating your skin that would be safer.
Well, this gets to a broader issue, and I'm a mom, so full disclosure here. But, I mean, how do we know something's safe? How do we know that we can trust brands or suppliers? I know that there was some recent media coverage over the Honest brand and that they were maybe misrepresenting or they had been misrepresented to them what was in their supply chain. So what is your best advice to consumers in terms of these types of household products?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, historically in the U.S., we haven't always, we often, we don't assess the safety of a material before it goes on the market. Rather, that kind of evaluation is often post-market, and in many cases we raise concerns. So I think we need a chemicals policy that really puts an emphasis on testing for safety, understanding the fate in the environment. In other words, where it goes, does it get into water? Does it get into soil? Does it get into food? What does it change into? And if and how we're exposed to it. And that kind of work should be done ahead of time. And right now, I think if going backwards, we need to focus on the high-use chemicals that are used right now that haven't yet been evaluated. Going forward, I think we need to really, again, apply these principles and see if in animal studies or other settings we don't see effects. One of the problems here is that we have so many chemicals, and it would take, you know, probably generations to test all of them. So in that sense, I think we need to support new evaluation methods, and EPA is actually working on strategies to do better screening using cells and other approaches. There's also the European Union and the U.S. is developing what are called QSAR programs, and these are quantitative structure activity relationship models. It's a big mouthful, but the idea there is to try to look at the structure of chemicals and then see if other ones that we don't have never been tested, are they similar to ones where we have some information, and can we predict toxicity? These kinds of activities are the universe of science and policy implications that I think can change the way things are done. However, we do know for the list we have here and other chemicals that are currently in use, there are exposures going on right now that are likely unacceptable, and we can take action to reduce those. And in some cases, we probably don't need them. I mean, I think fragrances is a good example in many cleaning products. They may exacerbate asthma in some cases, and they don't really provide a necessary function. I think there's an opportunity to make choices that reduce exposures.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. Irva?
Yeah, I just wanted to interject. I think everything that Asa has said and that Sonia has said about being proactive and the sort of changing the whole framework in which we regulate, and this is really what the Project Tender group has come together around, is really changing the paradigm of how we can become, instead of reactive and post, you know, waiting for the harm to occur, that the regulatory framework has to be changed. And, you know, we're calling for establishing an authoritative body that would be evaluating chemicals for neurodevelopmental toxicity in the way that we actually, there is a body that evaluates chemicals for carcinogenicity, for cancer. It's called the International Agency for Research on Cancer, and they have a whole program and have been doing that for many, many decades. We need to be doing that for children's environmental health, and particularly focusing on neurodevelopment. So, you know, all of the issues around substitutions and, you know, what parents can do is, yes, they can read labels and all of the things that Sonia said, and also be active in talking to their congressional and senatorial representatives about changing this our system, which has really failed our children, and we're treating them sort of like the canaries in the coal mine with regard to these neurodevelopmental effects, because the same chemicals often cause a lot of other harm as well.
Thanks, Irva. We're going to go to Marina in Berkeley. Marina, you're on.
Hi. Just want to say first, thank you so much for today's show. Thank you to all the panelists for participating. This hits very close to home for me. I have a chronic hypothyroid issue that was very likely caused by environmental contamination when I was a child in Los Angeles, the leaching of perchlorates into the groundwater from the manufacturing of U.S. arms explosives. So I've dealt with the consequences for decades now from environmental contamination. And just want to ask, thank you for the tips around, you know, not microwaving plastics, for, you know, using, eating organic food, et cetera. I think the last remaining question that's on my mind, hearing about the flame retardants, is what do we do about that? Do we buy used furniture or just organic furniture? Like, what do you recommend specifically around eliminating that from our bodies? Thank you.
Thanks, Marina. That's a great question. And also it gets to the issue of cost. I mean, not everybody can go out and buy all these things or replace their entire house full of furniture, right, Sonia? So what kind of advice would you give folks?
Well, California law has changed and now allows manufacturers to make new products without these toxic chemicals in the foam to ensure fire safety through other methods. So that helps when you're buying a new product. You should look at the label or contact the manufacturer, both for baby products or couches and easy chairs and other things like that. But it is tricky for people. We buy and own furniture for a long time. We promote doing that as an environmentally friendly practice. There are some companies that will replace the foam in the cushions in your couch with fire retardant free foam. But it's another one of those warnings that we need to think very carefully about how we make products and make our food, because the effects of those decisions will linger with us for decades.
So, Asa, is there one, if you were going to replace one thing in your house, would it be your bed, your couch, your carpets? I mean, is there one thing that you would tell people, especially with children, to focus on?
Well, I think actually the comments earlier about dust control are really important. I think there's also a lot to be said to avoid wall-to-wall carpets, which tend to collect lots of dust, mold, you know, organisms and other things that can put stuff in the air and affect health. Area rugs are easier to clean. And there's a lot of good evidence to use those as an alternative and have hard surface floors that are easier to clean. The issues around flame retardants are it's challenging. I mean, I think the caller raised a really important point. I think this is going to become an environmental justice issue where we have people who have more resources and can purchase new furniture that's flame retardant free, and there's going to be this reservoir left in other communities, particularly low income communities. We've seen that with lead, where historically there's been a strong differential in exposure by ethnicity and social economic status in the U.S., with lower income populations having higher exposures. And I think you raise a point I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think we need good outreach and this is a place where we need change in terms of the materials we use.
Great. Well, we have a couple online comments. Eden writes, let's talk about all the bromide being sprayed on our food, furniture, and clothes. It's a toxic chemical banned in Europe, Canada, and the UK. Be very afraid. Marvin also writes, why do we always hear the familiar rhetoric about XYZ being dangerous for children? Any savvy person knows XYZ, whatever it is also dangerous to adults as well. By framing the discussion about children, everyone who does not have children, whose children are grown up, will tune out. Asa got to this earlier, that kids are more affected, but I think this is certainly an issue for everyone. I want to go to Betty in San Francisco. Hi, Betty. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question regarding bed effect. I have a 25-year-old, and when he was about a year old, he had 16 ear infections. When he was a year and a half, he had 16 ear infections, and every time the doctor prescribed antibiotics. But also, his lead number was at 6. I noticed that he started having, like, OCD tendencies when he was, like, 7, 8 years old. And now that he's, you know, in his 20s, he started researching, and he swears that he has autism. I don't see the signs of that, but I see that he's over-obsessive. He has social anxiety. So I wanted to know psychological effects of possibly lead or the antibiotics. Thank you. And I'll answer off on there.
Thanks. Irva Hirsch-Picciotto, is that something you want to talk about? Is the actual effects of lead that we know on kids who are exposed early in life?
You know, there is some evidence that lead, and actually many of these chemicals, alter the immune system and may, in fact, and I'll point particularly at polychlorinated bisphenols, the PCBs, which were phased out quite a while ago. But there is quite a bit of literature suggesting that they reduce they basically cause your immune system to be less effective in fighting off infections. And so PCBs are still around, just like the PVDs, which I mentioned earlier. They last for a very long time. And so there's plausibility there, not just lead, but also PCBs and some of these other chemicals. And so that, you know, I we can't diagnose over the phone,
right.
And I'm not a clinician to do that even in person. But these kinds of stories of things that we didn't used to see, you know, adults having chronic infections of that sort, could well be related to chemicals in the environment. And to the caller who said we need to pay attention to adults as well, absolutely, absolutely. But on the other hand, there is this greater heightened sensitivity, and it is sometimes easier to get the attention of our legislators by focusing on children. There's this emotional appeal, and so I'm with you that it's everyone, and elderly people as well are at higher risk. And there is now actually a lot of evidence that growing evidence, I should say, that some of the neurodegenerative diseases may in fact be related to air pollutants and other chemical toxins.
Thanks, Irva. Next, we're going to go to Max in the East Bay. Max, you're here.
Yes, hi. I'm from eastbaypesticidealert.org. We've been around for years and followed Sonoma Pesticide Alert. And what I wanted to say is that there has been some talk of synergism, but I'm not sure I heard that word. Most in any pesticide product or other chemical product, you'll often see active ingredients versus inerts. Inerts are not what people tend to think of as inert, but they are instead simply like supporting actors for what is called the active ingredients. So when people call for no more use of glyphosate in the hills, where trees are being downed to the tune of close to 500,000, and there are herbicide pesticides being used around, glyphosate is just one. It's just one part of a product. It doesn't go out alone. And there are many other herbicides, as was referred to earlier in the program, that are right there standing as part of the backup. They're part of the program, so you could get rid of glyphosate or you could get rid of the whole product of Roundup, and you'd still have other products being used instead. So this is a regular feature of our world. They translocate through the soil.
All right. Thank you, Max. I really appreciate your call. We're going to move on to Judith in San Francisco. Judith, you're here.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you so much for the show. I have a six-month-old granddaughter, and everything goes in the mouth. She sucks on everything. And I'm wondering, she particularly likes labels. And I'm wondering, how safe are these? These baby toys.
Yeah, that's a great question, Judith. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the toys that she mentioned.
She was talking about the labels on toys.
Okay.
So, Irva, what do you suggest for people on this? I mean, I know that there's a lot of there's a lot of organic brands and other options, and I know we're getting a lot of questions about individual brands. We have posted a link to the Environmental Working Group's consumer guide on our website at kqed.org/forum. But generally, for babies, I mean, that is a huge issue, right? Putting things in the mouth.
Right. Well, that's normal behavior for babies. We learn about our environment often as young kids through our mouths, and that's why children are often exposed by that route. There are products out there, though, that are safe. I mean, there's been a movement away, for example, from phthalates in toys, wood products, but of course nothing that would splinter. There's silicone-based products that are likely safer, although, again, we want to make sure we avoid additives that leach, like phthalates. But there are products out there that are safe. I don't think people should panic about these exposures, but we should understand that we live in an environment where we're often exposed to chemicals in a lot of different settings, and often we can take individual steps to reduce those exposures. So I would recommend, you know, choosing toys that are safer. Household cleaning products are another arena that was mentioned earlier, where we can also choose safer products. And there is, for example, third-party certification that can actually provide a really sound confirmation that the materials have been reviewed and safe. EPA has developed what they call the Safer Choice Program for chemicals, and they're now publishing on their website evaluations of ingredients in many products. And that's the beginning of kind of the information and evaluation that we need to make better choices and also formulate better products.
And so, Sonia, obviously we mentioned EWG's consumer guide, and I know you guys have worked hard to make that as accessible as possible. Can you just tell us a little bit about it? Because I think we're getting a lot of questions about specific products here.
Yeah, so our Healthy Living app has a guide to ingredients and products that are used on your body, body care products and food. We have more than, 120,000 products in the app right now and barcode scanning. We also have an online guide to household cleaners where we review the ingredients that are on the label and point out any problems that we see or hazards that have been identified for ingredients. But with cleaning products, there's much more of a challenge because companies aren't required to fully name and disclose all the ingredients in the cleaning product. And so often we will see something with only two ingredients on the label. One says, you know, cleaning agent, and the other says preservative. And so there's a lot more secrecy when it comes to those ingredients. And
great. Thank you, Asa. Thank you, Sonia. We were joined this hour by Sonia Lutter, who is Senior Analyst at the Environmental Working Group, Irva Hirsch-Picciotto, Chief of Environmental and Occupational Health at UC Davis's Public Health Sciences Department, and Asa Bradman, Associate Director of UC Berkeley's Center for Environmental Research and Children's Health. You can find more information about all of their work on our website. Thank you all very much for being part of our program. Form is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Julia Seiler. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online help from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Marisa Lagos, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.